Doctor's strike is in progress just when the Nigerian president Muhammadu Buhari is receiving treatment in a London hospital. According to union officials, close to 16,000 resident doctors are participating in this strike, which is indefinite. Most of the resident doctors are specialists who provide important healthcare services, especially in emergency wards. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
Iran and the other signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, held virtual talks on Friday to discuss the fate of the agreement. During the meeting attended by China, Russia, France, Germany, and Britain, along with Iran, the signatories agreed to hold in-person talks in Vienna on Tuesday. That will be part of the meetings of the Joint Commission of the Nuclear Deal. Later, White House spokeswoman Jen Psaki claimed there will be indirect talks with Iran in Vienna.
These talks will be structured around working groups that the EU is going to form with the remaining partners in the JCPOA, including Iran. And the primary issues that will be discussed are the nuclear steps that Iran would need to take in order to return to compliance with the JCPOA, and the sanctions relief steps the United States would need to take in order to return to compliance.
Tehran will hold no direct or indirect talks with Washington before it removes all anti-Iranian sanctions.
According to the immutable guidelines set out by Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, any outcome of the joint JCPOA commission meeting, which is based on the notion of step-by-step removal of sanctions, is unacceptable. According to the guidelines by the leader, the Islamic Republic will only return to its JCPOA commitments after the removal of all U.S. sanctions and Iran's verification of the move. The Islamic Republic will not hold any mediated or unmediated talks with the U.S. before all sanctions are lifted. Just as the U.S. left the 2015 nuclear deal without negotiations and imposed sanctions on Iran, it should now remove all sanctions without talks.
Iran signed into the 2015 nuclear deal and committed itself to limiting its civilian nuclear program in exchange for removal of all nuclear-related sanctions against the country. That was meant to ensure Iran benefits economically from the accord, but those benefits were scarce and fully evaporated after the former U.S. administration withdrew from the agreement in 2018 and imposed unilateral sanctions against Iran. Analysts say all Iran is saying is that a once-negotiated deal does not need to be renegotiated.
The deal was the result of negotiations. So the negotiations have already taken place. The deal tells all sides what they're supposed to do. So the Americans know exactly what they're supposed to do. There's nothing to negotiate. If they want the deal to work, they have to implement it. But if they want to take bits and pieces and think that they can gain concessions from Iran, Iran is not going to do that.
Almost 3 months into the Biden administration, Washington is yet to right Donald Trump's wrongs on the nuclear deal. Tehran is clearly seeing through Washington's empty rhetoric and is calling for action. On Friday, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi told a virtual meeting on the nuclear deal that the remedial measures Iran took after the U.S. withdrawal from the nuclear deal are reversible, but only after the removal of all anti-Iran sanctions and its verification by Tehran.
Israeli settlers have escalated their daily raids into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds in the last couple of days during their celebrations of one of the Jewish holidays known as Passover. On Thursday alone, hundreds of Israeli settlers raided the holy site under the protection of Israeli forces, according to the Muslim religious authorities, or what's known as the Awqaf, which administrates the compound. Palestinian officials denounced what they described as provocative moves, saying that Israel has simultaneously banned Palestinian worshippers from entering the mosque.
The Israelis are accompanied and protected by soldiers and are allowed to raid the site and desecrate it. The Israeli forces closed the markets and the shops in the old town. A number of Palestinian youths were detained. It was another occupation of the Al-Aqsa complex and the old town, but this time by the settlers along with the soldiers.
Israeli settler groups have called on their supporters to converge on the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex in celebration of Passover, which began on March 27 and lasts until April 3. Thousands of Israeli soldiers were deployed across Jerusalem Al-Quds to provide a protection to settlers who toured in groups the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound and took photos of several places. Other strict measures have also been taken on Friday to prevent Muslims reach the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Experts believe the incursions are part of Israel's policy to Judaize the holy site and expel the Palestinians out from the holy city.
The Israeli regime is escalating the situation in Jerusalem Al-Quds. It's only mounting tensions. The Israeli prime minister is facing internal problems and he's looking for ways to survive. He knows settlers will help him to do so. That is why he won't stop their acts. Therefore, the settlers are provided with a good opportunity to desecrate the site and provoke the Palestinians during their holidays.
Since its occupation of the Palestinian lands, Israel has been launching violent crackdown on Palestinians in different ways, especially when it serves Tel Aviv's interests. During the Jewish holidays, Israeli settlers escalate their raids into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Palestinians say the raids are provocative and pursue the policy of suppression by Israeli regime against the Palestinian people living in the holy city of Al-Quds. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
In the limelight.
Some Asian Americans in the U.S. are stuck in situations where every choice is bad and where authority figures have exacerbated problems rather than aiding solutions, says Scott Hershage, writer, in an article published under the heading Spree of Anti-Asian Violence in U.S. Has Long Roots. Stay tuned for more. In response to thousands of reported bias incidents, the call and budding movement to Stop Asian Hate has fostered an unprecedented wave of Asian American solidarity that has quickly spread nationwide following the Atlanta area shootings. This has been heavily driven by a collective sense of fear and outrage that anyone in the community might be the next target. Videos of Asian elders being attacked and, in extreme cases, killed by much younger men have gone viral, but so has the video of American-born Koreans. This seemingly random quality of anti-Asian violence draws Asian Americans from diverse backgrounds together through a process that scholar Yen Sprito has termed reactive solidarity. One of the most oft-cited accounts of anti-Asian violence occurred near Detroit in 1982. Vincent Chin, a Chinese-American man, died after being beaten on the head with a baseball bat by a white man, who witnesses said complained that Japanese competition was causing layoffs of American auto workers. Tragically, Chin's murder is only one of many examples of Asian Americans being targeted by assailants who can't tell Americans apart. In 1989, another Chinese-American, Jim Ming Hai Lu, died after an attack by two white brothers who were heard railing about the Vietnam War. In 1996, Tien Minh Lai, a Vietnamese-American, was stabbed to death by a neo-Nazi. 3 years later, Joseph Ileto, a Filipino-American postal worker, was shot and killed while delivering on his USPS postal route by a white supremacist who wanted him dead for being a Latino or Asian federal government employee. To situate discussions of anti-Asian violence in proper historical and structural context, we need to recover the overlooked histories that are generally known outside of their immediate time and place, only within small niches of Asian American scholars and activists. In 1992, a group of white men boastfully reported of a crusade to beat up people in Southwest Philadelphia. They were targeting a Southeast Asian refugee community that had resettled into a city structured by redlining, anti-blackness, bias, policing, capital flight, and segregation by race and class. One of the white men described to a Philadelphia magazine reporter in October 1992 how he and 14 others dragged Asian Americans at wheel off of local streetcars. Dissecting the construction of this feud necessitates tracing back how white and Asian populations would up in the overlapping spaces of neighborhood. The roots of white supremacist violence and vigilantism run deep in the city of brotherly love. As the co-authors of the book Philadelphia, Neighborhoods, Division, and Conflict in a Post-Industrial City wrote, fraternal bonds of whiteness constructed ghettos of opportunity surrounding bustling factories during the industrial era from the mid-19th to mid-20th centuries. By 1970s, however, automation and outsourcing caused multiple factories in the city's southwest to close, move, or downsize. As black areas of settlement expanded outward from the inner city, jobs and many white residents fled to the suburbs. Feeling left behind, some Philadelphia whites accustomed to segregation as the natural order grew resentful and violent. In 1979, two white men looking for N-word to shoot climbed onto a factory roof and killed 13-year-old Tracy Chambers, the first African-American who passed by. Some violent exchanges ensued between white and black youths. In 1985, a mob of 400 whites demanded that a black family vacate their home on a previously all-white block. The following month, arsonists burned it to the ground. Refugees displaced by the Vietnam War, which also spread to Cambodia and Laos, were initially resettled in more impoverished, majority black sections of the city. As researcher Ellen Sumkawa documented, slumlords had contracted with resettlement agencies to fill their vacant and deteriorating complexes with refugees given little to no choice in the matter. In 1980s, the neighborhood's core remained nearly all white. But the unwritten rule prohibiting sales to black buyers accelerated the fall of housing prices. Seeing a new escape hatch, dozens of white families began selling unlisted homes to Southeast Asian refugees for $15,000 to $20,000, circumventing fair housing policies. Shocked by the rapid turnover, some whites began harassing and intimidating their new neighbors. When reporters surveyed white men and boys in the area in the early 1990s, they found many who proudly declared they were skinheads, neo-Nazis, and members of white power gangs. Asian Americans are stuck in situations where every choice is bad and where authority figures have exacerbated problems rather than aiding solutions. Sometimes the best that community organizers can do is shine a light on the worst abuses and mitigate the worst harm. Still, what these grassroots organizers strive to do is uplift marginalized voices and concerns in order to get at the root causes of oppression. Their commitment to confronting anti-Asian racism and violence have thus led them to struggle against gentrification and police brutality and for the rights of immigrants, youth, workers, and small business owners. In so doing, they have fostered new bases for multi-racial coalitions and alliances.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to the debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Good to have you with us. Delegations from Iran and the remaining signatories to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action are meeting in Vienna. On the agenda is ways to revive the deal from which former President Trump quit and President Biden promised to return to. An informed source has told Press TV that the only way for Tehran to go back to full-scale implementation of the deal hinges upon the verifiable removal of all U.S. unilateral sanctions. Tehran says if Washington lifts all its sanctions, Iran will stop its remedial measures and resume full compliance. Now, what's future holding for the 2015 Iran nuclear deal? How can the talk result in a breakthrough? Joining me in tonight's debate are co-founder of the Transnational Foundation, Jan Oberg from Lund, and also we have Professor of World Studies at the University of Tehran, Mohammad Marandi, who is joining us out of the Iranian capital city, Tehran. Thank you for joining us on the program. Let's begin the show with what the head of the Iranian delegation at the talks in Vienna told Press TV right after the end of the first round of negotiations a couple of hours ago.
First, I'd just like to start with a question concerning comments that were published today in an interview with Mr. Mali, in which he says that the fact that Iran is calling for the removal of all of the sanctions before it can reverse its measures shows that Iran is not serious about reviving the deal. So are you saying then that after this session, are you saying that the U.S. has agreed on this demand from Iran that the U.S. should initially remove the sanctions fully before, and Iran should verify it before Iran can actually take action. Is that what the U.S. has agreed to?
Well, the U.S. was not in the session. What we had today was the Joint Commission of the JCPOA, and U.S. is not a participant. So we don't have any negotiation with the U.S., even indirect negotiations. What we do is to negotiate with the JCPOA participant, which you can perhaps say P4 plus one. P4 plus one would then later would talk with Americans. And that is their business. We are not engaged in that business. We only negotiate with P4 plus one, and we would. We have told them very clearly what is our position. What Mr. Mali has said is, in fact, a sign of the lack of seriousness in their side, because they have left the JCPOA and they have imposed sanctions. So obviously, if they want to come back, they have lifted all those sanctions altogether in one step. That is quite logic, and that is a very reasonable demand by the Islamic Republic of Iran. We only go back to full compliance when the U.S. has lifted all sanctions imposed or reimposed or relabeled after January 2017 and has verified by the Islamic Republic of Iran. Then we would go for full compliance. So we have to make it clear that this is our position, but we are quite serious. I have come here to do business, but I doubt that there is the same seriousness in the other side. If the U.S. is serious, they should be prepared to lift all sanctions that they have imposed or reimposed against Iran. And after verification, we certainly go back to full compliance. If we wanted to avoid full compliance to the JCPOA, we would have done it before. We would have totally withdrawn from the JCPOA once the U.S. The previous U.S. administration left the JCPOA. So we are quite serious. Nobody can question Iran's goodwill. The JCPOA is alive because of Iran, and we have paid a heavy price for that. Our people have suffered from the sanctions imposed by the United States. And now, if they want to revive JCPOA, if they want to come back to the JCPOA, they should lift all sanctions at once.
Okay, now that was part of what Mr. Araghchi had to say. Now, let me go to London and ask Jan Oberg. As you heard, Mr. Araghchi stressed Iran opposes Washington's step-by-step offer. Iran insists the process should happen in one stage only. That is, the U.S. must lift all the sanctions to be able to go back to the JCPOA. Let's have your take.
Well, I think my take is very close to what we just heard. I have seldom been involved in a conflict where the parties were so clearly on the wrong side and right side. In most conflicts, you know, there are gray nuances on all sides. First of all, it's pretty obvious to the whole world that it was the United States that in 2015 participated in the negotiations and signed the deal under President Obama, whose vice president was the present president, Biden. So he knows what is in the deal. Now then, there comes in an administration that decides to leave, depart from, which is a break of international law because the deal was an appendix to the UN Security Council resolution, and then comes back with what is basically a Trump standpoint, that we can bully the world, we can do what we please, we can do this and that, we can demand this and that, and they must go first and all this. I mean, it's very simple to me, and that's my take on it to answer your question. Mm-hmm. The U.S. has left, and it should join, and the U.S. has installed new sanctions on the Trump, and they should leave them and drop them. And then we are back to zero, if you will, or to the situation we were in. And it seems to me that, I mean, why does the United States not accept that there is a world out there and it cannot just bully and do what it wants and pleases? That time is over.
Okay, now back to Tehran. Mohammed, what do you expect to come out of the Vienna talks? Russian delegations call it constructive. The Iranian delegation has dubbed it Russians have said that successful. Iranians saying it's constructive. Now, will the sessions that will be pursued on Friday come up with a pathway to settlement or what?
Well, the Iranian deputy foreign minister has said that there is no halfway settlement. It's all or nothing. The Iranians are not going to go through the same difficulties that it went before, and that is itself abiding by all of its commitments and then the Americans failing to abide by its commitments. Under Obama, the United States was dishonest. When the two sides signed the JCPOA, the Iranians immediately went and implemented the deal. They carried out all its obligations. And then the Americans dragged their feet. In some cases, they openly violated the deal, like passing the Iran Sanctions Act, which was a clear violation. This was under Obama. But what was even worse was that the United States, on paper, did one thing, but in reality, it did something else. So, for example, the U.S. government threatened banks, financial institutions, and shipping companies, as well as insurance companies, among others, and told them that you should not do business with Iran, otherwise you'll get into trouble. Bankers from the EU came to me, to my office, as an academic, to consult me about the situation. They told me themselves specifically that the Americans warned them not to do business with Iran. That was a clear violation. Mm-hmm. And the Iranian side, I think, was deceived by the Americans at the negotiating table and subsequently, because the Iranians assumed, I guess, that the Americans would act in good faith. So this time around, the Iranians are not going to accept that. The Iranians are saying verification, full implementation and verification. This is a deal that was signed by the Obama administration. Biden was the vice president, so he accepts this deal, and therefore he has to implement the deal. If the Americans implement it, if it's verified, the Iranians will have no problem implementing the deal, because the Iranians have a long history of full implementation.
Okay. Now, let's listen to another piece of the comments made by Iranian chief nuclear negotiator, and I will ask you to comment on that.
After this discussion that you've had, the discussions here in Vienna, are we going to witness a change in the process or the kind of nuclear activities that are being carried out by Iran?
No. Before we come to any conclusion, there won't be any change in our policy.
And what about the pace of Iran's enrichment up to 20%? Is that going to undergo any change?
Well, no. What we are doing in 20% enrichment or any other activity in our nuclear program is based on our own needs, and that would be decided and planned by the Iran's Atomic Energy Organization. We are not going to change any policy before the U.S. is fully back to the JCPOA.
And just finally, the Russian ambassador said that he believed the talks today were successful. Do you see this these discussions as successful, positive? Do you think that the sides are on the right track and that this is going to lead to the eventual revival of the deal?
I think it was constructive and in the right track. It's too soon to say that it has been successful. That would be known after the work of the working groups. But, of course, we are hopeful. If we were not hopeful, we would have not been here. We would move based on our own policies, on our own instructions. If the other side can meet our demands, of course, then we can say that it's a successful negotiations.
Okay, now, let me ask Yan about what he thinks about what the Iranian nuclear chief negotiator said, especially regarding the fact that he just stressed that Iran is not going to change any of its policy activity before the U.S. returns to the deal. And you know what we mean by U.S. returning to the deal.
Well, I think it would be obvious to the world that if the U.S. stood by its word, it would have been better. Now, the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the JCPOA, and the only way I see, and in that sense I completely agree with what was said, there's only one way back, and that is that the U.S. repairs its foolish policies by going back to the deal and lifting the sanctions it put on Iran unilaterally. And secondly, I don't understand why this should be so difficult for the U.S., except because you're a superpower and you think you can get away with everything and bully the world. That type of world does not exist anymore, because the U.S. is in decline on all important indicators. I don't understand why Biden should need a quid pro quo, some kind of deal, a new deal or something like that. He would be immensely popular everywhere, including in Europe, where the secondary sanctions have been so hurtful to European industry, because as we just heard, you know, Europe would be punished if it exported or traded with Iran. I have experienced this myself, because I tried through the Nordea Bank to send a little sum for humanitarian aid when you had floods in Iran. It was returned because they could not send a few dollars. It was blocked. You couldn't send anything, not even humanitarian assistance to Iran. And so what I'm saying is, he would be popular. He would be looking like a decent man, saying, oh, the fool who was there before me, I'm now repairing what he did wrong. Let's get to the table. Let's get moving on and find some kind of win-win situation for Iran and us. And, you know, if Iran should say, yeah, okay, we'll do this and that, that it pleases the U.S., why should they? I mean, the U.S. has cheated Iran a number of times. And secondly, there is no way in that case that the Americans would then not raise new demands, such as we have to discuss, you know, all kinds of issues that was not in the 2015 deal. So I would completely agree. You have to stand firm now and say, repair the foolish things you did on your side, and then we can talk.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's common sense. I mean, it's common sense and it's fairness.
Sure. Now, Professor Marandi, are you optimistic that Washington will take the required action and help revive the Iran nuclear deal? You know, head of the Iranian negotiator said that he's in Vienna to do business, but he's wondering if the other side is serious enough. He also reminded the fact that Iran has paid a heavy price to keep the JCPOA alive, and the other side has not done much.
Yes, it doesn't seem as if he is particularly optimistic, and why should he be? If Biden was serious, he could have signed presidential decrees during the very first day of his presidency, like he did with a host of other issues, but he didn't. He continued Trump's maximum pressure campaign. So Biden continues to target Iranian women and children. On the other hand, we have to remember that Biden has a very dark history. The dirty war in Syria grew very horrible during the period when he was the vice president. And we know that Jake Sullivan, who is now his national security advisor, on February 12, 2012, said that al-Qaeda is on our side in Syria. So from the very beginning in Syria, they were working with al-Qaeda, the same group that a decade before had attacked the United States. When he was vice president, the United States destroyed Libya. The United States gave the green light to Saudi Arabia to bring about genocide in Yemen. And of course, the sanctions targeting women and children in Venezuela. And of course, the whole maximum pressure campaign against Iran that Trump pursued was initiated by Obama. And again, Biden was his vice president. And it was only after the United States agreed to that it would not complain and that it would recognize Iran's right to enrichment that talks began in the first place. So Biden is not a humane person. He's committed all sorts of atrocities. And so the Iranians don't have great expectations. But the United States needs an agreement. If they didn't need an agreement, they wouldn't be so keen on negotiating. Mm-hmm. So the Iranians have leverage. The difficulties inside the United States make it more difficult for the United States to impose its hegemony over the rest of the world. So that helps to weaken the sanctions.
The United States needs an agreement, and the Iranians know that, but Iranians are not going to appease the United States. It's full implementation, verified implementation, then full Iranian implementation. There's no other model. There's no other way out of this.
Okay. Now, Yan, U.S. officials are also attending the Vienna talks on the JCPOA. Of course, Tehran has asserted it's not going to negotiate with them, be it directly or indirectly. Now, is the U.S. presence there a good omen, or is it just publicity stunt by the Biden administration?
I really cannot tell. I would be honest with you if I said I knew that the answer to that question. But I could have a nasty mind that you want these negotiations. You play the game that you want some kind of, you know, impossible thing to happen, and then you say, "Oh, there you see, Iran is not willing to do anything. We better." Use bigger languages, bigger letters with them. And here I think of the likelihood of some kind of bombing of facilities or something like that. I would not be surprised. There's nothing that, there's little that should surprise us by now. And I do find it strange that you have this policy in the Biden administration and at the same time trying to look like you want to find a solution, because what you're offering is totally of no interest to the Iranian side, and it's Iran who has legality and morals on its side in this case. So, you know, if all this fails and nothing else works, my hope would be that the world, including particularly, but I'm not very hopeful about the European countries, EU countries, a global civil disobedience campaign, and that company after company, bank after bank, in the hundreds of thousands begin to work and break these secondary sanctions, begin to work and say, sorry over there in Washington, we have our interest too, and we're not going to accept that American law is implemented on European or other territories. And the second thing that is likely to happen, and that's why I say all these policies are self-defeating for the United States. So it's the Cold War with Russia, so it's the emerging Cold War with China. Mm-hmm. It tells me that there's no sense of reality in Washington at the moment. But, you know, what it ends up with rather quickly, and there are very clear signs of it, is that country after country will turn its back on the United States and the West. And it cannot be in the interest of anybody in the West that that happens. But I'm not very optimistic, as I said, because the European Union is simply not able to get its act together on any important issues, as right. we've seen most lately in the case of the Corona, meeting the Corona challenge.
Exactly. Okay, Mohammed, some observers argue that this could be the last chance for the nuclear deal, given the Iranian parliament's stance and also the upcoming presidential election here in Iran. Do you agree?
The implementation of the nuclear deal doesn't have anything to do with the Iranian presidential election. Ayatollah Khamenei said Iran is very patient and we're not in a hurry. And that basically means that we're not going to rush into some sort of situation where we do not get exactly what we are supposed to get in the nuclear deal. Iran this time around is going to learn from its past experience. In the past, forget Trump. Trump, of course, tore the deal, imposed maximum pressure. He's gone now. Mm-hmm. Biden, who claims to want to go back to the deal, he has to implement the deal. The deal under Obama-Biden wasn't implemented. They cheated Iran. The negotiations had flaws, and the Americans took advantage of the flaws in the agreement. The Iranians are now saying, we won't let that happen again. Okay. The agreement has to be fulfilled in full. The example I gave is a key example. The Iranians need to be able to use the global financial sector. The U.S. sanctions, by the way, are completely illegal. They are utterly illegal. And they're directed at third countries. It's a thuggish policy to threaten countries who work with Iran with sanctions. But in any case, Iran, the most important thing for Iran, among many important things, is for Iran to be able to use the global banking sector.
Okay.
And the United States never allowed that to happen under Obama and Biden.
So this time around, the Iranians, that's why the Iranians are very clear about verification. It must be implemented in full and verified.
Right.
No matter how we talk about it, this is the ultimate result that will be acceptable to Iran.
Okay, unfortunately, we're out of time. I have to jump it. I'm sorry. That's all the time we have. Let me thank our guests. We had co-founder of the Transnational Foundation, Jan Olberg, from Lund, Sweden, and professor of world studies at the University of Tehran, Mohammad Marandi, who joined us from Tehran.
Limelight. Nasser Kandil, a well-known Lebanese journalist, warns about an underway campaign that seeks to alter the country's political configuration in a way that would mount excessive pressure on the resistance. We now present you an article authored by Robert Inlakesh, a journalist, writer and political analyst who has lived in and reported from occupied Palestinian West Bank. The piece is titled Western Media Conspiracy Theories About Hezbollah Distract from Lebanon's Real Issues. Lebanon is clearly facing a crisis so severe that the country verges on complete collapse, but regardless of what the facts indicate, the Western Persian Gulf media continues to make the issue about Hezbollah. Following the nationwide protests over corruption and economic despair in October of 2019, Lebanon was plunged into an even greater crisis after former Prime Minister Saadeddine Hariri resigned. Despite several attempts to form a technocratic government, they have all, up to this point, failed and or formed only to quickly resign. Prime Minister-designate Saadeddine Hariri reportedly met again with the country's President Michel Aoun on Monday, 5th of April, in order to discuss the issue of government formation. Although there have been almost 20 meetings between the two men, yet they have not announced any breakthroughs. According to the International Monetary Fund, the Lebanese economy has shrunk 25% in the last year. The World Bank also reports that 50% of the country's population are below the poverty line, whilst the local currency has lost 90% of its value. Instead of the Western media focusing on the real underlying causes behind Lebanon's steep economic decline, they managed to turn everything into imaginative but infantile conspiracy theories instead, focusing on an alleged conspiracy in which the Lebanese Islamic Resistance Movement Hezbollah is secretly behind all of Lebanon's woes. The Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs is one such place that such conspiracy theories are found. According to a baseless claim by the Tel Aviv-based group, a scenario that could emerge as a result of Lebanon's economic collapse is the following. Iran will bring warships into the port of Beirut and take it over, take advantage of Hezbollah's control of Beirut International Airport and use it as a military airfield for its own purposes. At the same time, it will establish a military airfield in Baalbek. The fact that such a thing could even be published should come as something of a joke, but unfortunately some actually think that this scenario is likely to occur. On the contrary, the Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement, Seyed Hassan Nasrallah, has instructed the group to help those from all sects where possible and has called openly for formation of a technocratic political government. The hardships currently facing the Lebanese people are also not caused by Hezbollah in any way, for if there was any proof available to present to the public, that would be the main focus of the opinion pieces published by the likes of the New York Times and the Washington Post. Instead, what we see are pieces produced to condemn the group for pretty much everything else, ignoring the good done by the organization, such as aiding the Lebanese people throughout the ongoing pandemic and aiding needy people in general, as well as aiding those affected by Israeli military assault. The way that Lebanon operates is not like most other countries. Lebanon's constitution, that was adopted back in 1926 and set into law a system of confessionalism, which is to mean a de jure mix of religion and politics. The constitution itself, written by the French High Commissioner at the time, decided that there would be rules which dictate that the government would be run by different groups. This translated into the president always remaining a Maronite Christian, the prime minister of Lebanon a Sunni Muslim, and the speaker of parliament a Shia Muslim, and so on and so forth. Many Lebanese call into question the way in which the constitution, written under French rule, has fed into some divides, and we see today in the country. That is to say that Lebanon is governed by some officials who primarily take care of their own, and the government is not the sole provider for the people. Just a few years ago, Lebanon was a relatively stable country, and now it has started to shape up to its neighbor Syria economically. Lebanon's agricultural industry has been destroyed. Its biggest import partner, Syria, is under the chokehold of sanctions, which by extension target Lebanon too. The people of Lebanon have chosen to move their money out of the country, whilst non-governmental organizations are ever present and causing their own problems. Also, Lebanon has taken in as many as 1.5 million Syrian refugees, which has had its own impact on the country's economy. Then we have the foreign investors and tourists from the Persian Gulf Arab countries, and the fact that they largely control large portions of the economy. On top of this was the horrific Beirut explosion last year, which destroyed the country's primary port and highlighted the level of foreign interference and economic problems. But for all these problems and more, the Lebanese Islamic Resistance Movement Hezbollah is not to blame. The real reason we see so much attention placed upon Hezbollah is because they threaten the United States' top ally in the region, the Israeli regime. It is not because they are part of an alleged conspiracy to militarily take over Lebanon, or because they are the sole cause of the nation's financial crisis. It is because they were the ones to expel the Israeli occupation forces from southern Lebanon. It is for this reason that we see such disproportionate attention placed upon them in the media. Because if a civil war is manufactured in order to weaken them, this works in favor of the Israeli regime and the United States of America. Meanwhile, the well-known Lebanese journalist Nasser Gandil has warned about a campaign already underway that seeks to alter the country's political landscape in a way that would mount excessive pressure on the resistance axis. Nasser Gandil, a well-known journalist and editor of the Lebanese newspaper Al-Binar, said recently, "An external political campaign has been formed since the beginning of the country's crisis, with the aim of using the critical situation to create a new political reality in order to lay siege on the Lebanese Islamic Resistance Movement." He said the campaign had been formed with the support of media outlets and civil organizations, as well as elements both inside and outside of the country. Commenting on foreign sources' contribution to the campaign, Nasser Gandil identified the United States and France as the countries that have potentially fomented the crisis. The United States incessantly tries to interfere in Lebanon's domestic affairs, in favor of the Israeli regime. It has imposed economic sanctions on Lebanon to weaken the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah, which has defended the country against two Israeli wars and repeated Israeli aggression and violations. Meanwhile, France, Lebanon's former colonial ruler, is accused of trying to impose its political will on the country by pressing it to implement certain reforms. The well-known Lebanese journalist Nasser Randil says Washington and Paris only claim to seek Lebanon's betterment whilst they take no action that could mirror their expression of such interest. He cited a recent overflight of Lebanon's coastline by an American drone, saying the unmanned aerial vehicle had patrolled the area in line with Washington's military ambitions for the country, not to pursue an alleged Russian submarine, as Washington has claimed. Mandil remarked, at the same time as it tries to find a military foothold in Lebanon, the United States also tries to weaken the Lebanese currency against the US dollar, so the Lebanese army grows more dependent on financial assistance from the Americans. However, Russia has tried to play a positive role towards resolution of the Lebanese crisis by recently hosting a Hezbollah delegation in Moscow and advising various parties in Lebanon to meet halfway towards formation of an official cabinet. Lebanon is experiencing its worst economic crisis in decades, compounded by the COVID-19 pandemic. Prices are skyrocketing and more than half of the population is now living below the poverty line. Nasser Gandil refused to consider the crisis and the protest that it has brought about to be simply self-sprung, saying the national currency's devaluation could not be tied to economic factors alone. He noted, "There are political efforts underway to pressure the market, thus provoking the people and paving the way for anarchy and insecurity." Delivering a recent speech, the Secretary General of Lebanon's Islamic Resistance Movement Hezbollah, said Hassan Nasrallah, also identified the pressure that the United States was applying to Lebanon as a main factor driving the current crisis in the country. Said Hassan Nasrallah stated that the United States wants Lebanon to be placed in the U.S.-Israel axis in the same way that such regional countries as the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain have done by normalizing their relations with the Israeli regime through Washington's facilitation. Nasser Gandil voiced support for the solutions that have been proposed by Sayed Hassan Nasrallah towards ending the crisis in Lebanon, including reformation of the country's bureaucratic and financial structure and potential formation of a technocratic political government.